It's a Walnut Wednesday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Hello, everyone. I'm Lori Boyer. Thanks for tuning in. We get started here on the show today with a report from Taylor Chalstrom talking about how to confront scale species in orchards. That is coming up right after a word from our sponsor.
Being a member of the California walnut industry means working together to advance the industry through advocacy, research programs, and promoting walnuts with smart, cost-effective marketing. Learn more at walnuts.org.
Depressed walnut prices and higher input costs have put a premium on pest management decisions and increased the importance of dormant monitoring for scale pests in walnuts. UCIPM pest management guidelines advise growers and crop consultants to monitor scaffolds, limbs, branches, and prunings in the dormant period for San Jose scale, Italian pear scale, and most prominently for walnut scale and frosted scale. At high populations, walnut and frosted scales can reduce yields and quality and create issues with other plant pests, particularly Botryos spherea. Emily Sims, former UCCE IPM advisor and current senior manager of technical field services for Sutera, went in depth into some of these more prominent scale pests in walnut and some of the dangers they can pose.
The two primary scale species that tend to rise to the level of requiring treatment are walnut scale and frosted scale. There are also San Jose scale, Italian pear scale, and European fruit lichenium that might be found in orchards. And often these are not typically to high enough levels to be of concern for treatment. It really is walnut scale and frosted scale that we tend to focus on. Walnut scale, San Jose scale, and Italian pear scale are what we call hard scales or armored scales. And the cover of these, the scale cover, is this kind of flattened shape, and it's actually separate from the insect body underneath. This is kind of important when we start talking about some monitoring approaches. With frosted scale and European fruit lichenium, these are what are called soft scales, kind of a different general category of the overall classification of scales. And in that case, it's a much more domed body, and the actual scale cover and body are all one kind of single unit. All of these scale pests feed with piercing, sucking mouth parts. So they pierce into the plant and suck out plant juices. This in turn is one of the chief concerns with the scale infestation, because these openings can create entry points for pathogens. Specifically of concern is Botryos spherea. And so that's one of the chief dangers of having a scale infestation in the orchard. Soft scales actually produce honeydew, because they feed on the phloem. So honeydew is that kind of sugary exudate that they will secrete as a byproduct of their feeding. The hard scales do not. So a bit of an additional consideration when you have soft scales is this honeydew production, which can then can facilitate the growth of sooty mold and potentially lead to sunburn, increased likelihood of sunburn in walnuts, which is a big issue. Typically low to moderate overall population levels, if we take out the Botryos spherea concern, are not terribly damaging to the plant. But anytime you get a high enough population Botryos spherea aside, it can cause some decline in plant health and dieback and things like that. So we do have to keep an eye on these different pests.
Out of the scale species that Sims listed, the walnut scale, of course, is the most detrimental to walnut trees. Sims said it looks more or less like a crusty barnacle on the tree and can be hard to see. And really, the only type of scouting that growers and consultants have is visual.
We don't have like traps and lures necessarily for these, so we're out looking for visual signs of the actual population itself, and we can monitor the crawler stage to some degree, but really what is suggested is to get out during the dormant period when the populations are quite visible, you don't have a lot of foliage that you're dealing with, and doing your dormant scout and actually looking for any and all of these species. So you'll be looking for evidence of walnut scale. So these kind of small white sort of almost daisy shaped clusters of the scale cover. It's really important that as you're scouting these populations, that you're confirming that they are an active infestation, meaning that they're actually still alive. With the hard scales, that scale cover can stay attached to the plant surface long after the insect underneath is dead, either from parasitization or an earlier chemical treatment. And so I always suggest taking a small blade, the tip of your knife or fingernail, if you can, scraping off some of the scale covers. And looking beneath, walnut scale has a bright kind of yellow body underneath if it's still alive. And if you poke into that and it squishes, you know you've got a live one on your hand. If you take that scale cover off and the body beneath is a little darker and translucent and flecks off really easily, that means that that particular organism is already dead. And so before you decide to do a treatment, as we know, 2022 is going to be another year of uncertainty with water availability of resources, with supply chain. And certainly we only want to treat when we absolutely have to prevent economic damage. So make sure that those populations are alive. At the same time, treatment thresholds or decision to treat should also heavily rely on how much natural biological control you're observing in the orchard. There are some effective parasitoids that kind of when left to flourish and not destroyed by some of our other practices can provide some pretty good control of these populations. And you'll just look for what are quite obvious, they're exit holes in the scale cover. So you'll see a perforated hole in the scale cover. That's where the adult parasitoid has emerged. And if you see a significant level of parasitism, you may choose to just let the biological control flourish and not treat necessarily at this particular time. The UCIPM website has some great visual resources for what to look for with each of these species with the dormant monitoring form. I did briefly mention monitoring crawlers. That's something that's done later in season. The reason why you would want to monitor for crawlers is if you're actually going to do a crawler treatment. We do that. It's pretty rudimentary, double-sided sticky tape wrapped around the twig or branch near what looks like an active infestation. And then we can understand when the crawlers are emerging to time a potential crawler treatment or as evidence that an earlier treatment, a delayed dormant, was effective. So that's the other main scouting method or monitoring method.
Sims said that really for all of these species, particularly walnut and frosted scale, the delayed dormant period is the most ideal period of the season to treat from an operational and an efficacy standpoint.
You really just want to get out before shoot growth begins. And so you've got some flexibility. In addition, during that delayed dormant period, you don't have a lot of other spray operations that you might be juggling once you get into coddling moth treatment and things like that. And so while the crawler treatment can be effective, you've got to time that based on crawler emergence pretty tightly. The years that we were doing studies, the crawler emergence was widely variable year to year between, mid-April all the way out to mid-May. You've also got other operations there. You also have a lot more foliage, so you're not going to get quite the coverage. So delayed dormant probably is the Cadillac timing. If you miss it or didn't realize you had a problem until you saw crawlers emerge, then the crawler treatment is viable also. UC actually has some pretty great treatment guidelines for these different species. Italian parascale rarely requires an insecticide treatment on its own. It's typically associated with lichens. And if you can control the lichens with what's called a Bordeaux mixture, which is a combo copper sulfate, lime, and water, usually that scale population then reduces. So we're really talking about, walnut scale, frosted scale, and maybe if you've got some Lacanium or San Jose scale with the delayed dormant treatments. Again, UC has some pretty good treatment threshold guidelines. And in addition, former UC advisor Danny Lytle and I created a pretty neat visual decision tree for all of the species except Italian parascale with regard to treatment decision support. And that's available on the sacvalleyorchards.com website. If you go to walnut and scroll down to insects and pests, there's a blog post that says walnut dormant monitoring and treatment decisions. And we've created a nice graphic, basically decision tree for treatment there. The primary kind of insecticides of choice are insect growth regulators, either buprofurthin, which is trade name is Centaur, or pyraproxifen, trade name is Seize. Those seem to do the best job having the least non-target impacts to those parasitoids because they are more specific and less broad spectrum. Our research that we did a few years ago, Bob Van Steenwyck and myself, showed that we can actually suppress populations for multiple seasons after a treatment. And so it might not be that an annual treatment is needed, which circles back to the importance of that dormant monitoring to confirm whether your infestation is active.
Looking more into the biological side of treatment, many often wonder whether some of the biological species present in an orchard can interact with all of the scale pests or just certain scale species, or even the harder soft-shelled ones. Sims said, it's a little bit of all of that.
So typically you're going to have, if you have overlap between one particular parasitoid species, it probably will overlap more in the hard scale kind of family area. And then you'll have some separate species for the soft scales. And in some cases, the species are highly, highly specific just to one particular pest species. The ones that are highly specific can be very effective, but then when their food source runs out, they kind of dwindle also. So there are some other non-parasitoids, so like just the generalist predators, lacewing larvae, different things like that, that also can come in and help kind of clean things up in a more broadly general approach.
For scale pests specifically, they can often be hard to treat depending on the threshold.
It's really sometimes much easier to know when you need to, right? When you, I've got a problem, I need to, what's that line of, maybe I can hold off this year or this season. That's the little bit of art science nuance there, where certainly, you know, the university and research has these sometimes numeric guidelines, but, you know, you look to the PCA, you look to his or her, you know, experience, what they've learned year over year, block over block. And, you know, it's something that I don't think with scale that it can really blow up on you huge within a single year, but it's just that keep an eye on it over and over and over time. And then rely on your expertise. You know, how risk averse are you? How risk tolerant are you in terms of maybe incurring a little bit of damage? You know, again, unless the population is very high, in which case, you know, you need to treat just for plant health, take into consideration what your botrysphaeria load or pressure is in the environment too. That's actually one of the keys in terms of that decision-making. If you've got a, you know, moderate population of walnut scale with pretty decent parasitism and your bot's fairly under control in terms of inoculum resource, then maybe you skip it this year. If you're having a big bot problem, you're not getting a lot of parasitization, then maybe you go ahead and make that decision to treat this year.
As for the problem of scale pests in general in California and California walnuts, Sims said the problem isn't getting worse, per se.
I think with a lot of our pests in general, because they're driven by heat units and things like that, those that might add a generation a year and have more reproductive capacity, I've not heard that we're getting an extra generation yet of any of these scale species. There's still two generations per year apparent. So that seems to be relatively stable for the time being. I think that growers are understanding how to control it. The materials are working well. I say that for now, because as we know, when you're limited to just a few materials, the possibility of resistance developing is certainly there. So I would really encourage also that consideration of rotating the chemistries. The two growth regulators that we have are very different modes of action. They're both growth regulators, but one inhibits chitin synthesis. The other is a juvenile hormone mimic. So throwing those in rotation year over year, or whenever, whichever year you need to use them, could also be advantageous. So I think there's some level of stability in general from what I've heard, but with walnut scale and frosted scale, and in the time that I've been sort of active in the industry, it seems like there's a multi-year cycle. It can just be not dormant necessarily, but certainly just kind of at the stable level. And then all of a sudden we'll have a couple of years where it peaks and it becomes a big topic of conversation again, and then it wanes again. And why that is maybe a you know, natural factors or operational factors of different insecticide use. And we'll have to see as we're getting away from the broad spectrums, like chlorpyrifos, that maybe were more detrimental to the parasitoids, perhaps those populations will rebound and provide some good service going into the future.
Once again, a Walnut Wednesday report with Taylor Chalstrom. Coming up next, regional and national agricultural news and a check-in with the California Hemp Association.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, working together to advance the industry. Together, we can do more.
The Musco Family Olive Company is leading the transformation of the table olive industry. We are committed to the California olive grower and invite you to grow with our family. Modern table olive orchards apply newly perfected state-of-the-art planting and harvesting to one of the world's oldest tree crops for proven superior results. There is opportunity in any crop transition, and Musco is proud to offer long-term contracts and free trees to our grower partners. Visit us at the AgriMalora booth at the upcoming Calusa Farm Show and the World Ag Expo. See you there. In regional agricultural news today, Oxnard, California-based Bobaloo Berry Farms is celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. It is the first district in California each year bringing in the new year with a fresh new crop. They are pleased to announce that for the first time, they will have fresh berries all year long from California in 2022, according to Bobby Jones, managing partner. Bobaloo LLC typically relies fully on fresh volume from Mexico during winter months after the Santa Maria fall crop ends and before the spring crop kicks off in Oxnard. However, for the first time, the company has added a fall Oxnard crop in addition to Santa Maria's fall program that will come on a bit later, carrying fresh California fruit into 2023. Now, Oxnard will be the first and the last district harvesting each year for the company within the state. The addition of the crop from Mexico will complement domestic fruit, providing a beneficial overlap during the holidays. It is a direct result of the expanded demand the company has experienced due to quality and service. This added volume will also help to expand our food service business in 2022 as the company builds on this very important segment of this industry, according to Jones. And in some fun news, the California Walnut Commission is promoting walnut tacos. Specifically, the organization is promoting walnuts as a meat alternative. Pam Graviat of the California Walnut Commission explains.
Walnuts are an interesting nut where they can transform. So we've had wonderful success in some Asian as well as European countries where they've made, you take the walnut meat and you make it into a substitute for ground beef. Depending on the seasonings and how you prepare it, it loses some of the walnutty characteristics and takes on the spices, and it becomes an excellent plant-based meat substitute for something that requires like a beefy crumble or something of that nature.
With the main recipe they're promoting being walnut tacos. The recipe is online at walnuts.org. Growers and industry members in Riverside County and its surrounding areas are invited to attend a virtual citrus growing meeting on Wednesday, January 26th. The meeting will be on Zoom and will require registration to attend. As a result of the recent Huanglongbing quarantine expansion in parts of Riverside County, growers and citrus industry members will hear from staff members from the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Division and the Riverside County Agricultural Commissioner's Office on the current status of HLB in the area, as well as updates on current regulatory requirements. This is also a great opportunity to ask questions of the regulators. In addition, attendees will be able to learn more about the latest research from the University of California, Riverside. For more information, contact the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program at 916-654-0317.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
It's hard to predict the future when it comes to the American agricultural economy, and 2022 is no different. David Widmar, an agricultural economist with Agricultural Economic Insight, says there are several concerns in the months ahead.
the macroeconomy, the overall U.S. economy is on everyone's mind, and how things play out in 2022 could have long-term implications. And I think the other issue that's really important is the combination of production expenses and commodity prices. And right now, everything's tight, but probably doable. But if we see one of those really slip one way or the other, it could become challenging for producers to navigate.
He says inflation is the biggest concern when it comes to the macro economy.
Everyone right now is thinking about inflation, and I think that's true. We've seen data coming out of the Federal Reserve that said that inflation is pretty high. Thankfully, the duration has been pretty short. We haven't seen inflation lasting very long. Again, a year ago, we were looking at inflation rates in the 1% to 2% range. And so this has been a pretty short-term phenomenon. How much pain inflation causes is a function of the magnitude and the duration. We have a magnitude that's around 5.5%. The duration's been short. Of course, this is a concern, but we have to put it in the right context. Of course, the follow-up is what's going to happen with inflation.
The biggest economic question is what the Fed will do with interest rates and the effect it will have on inflation.
It's really important to think about how this unfolds. And if we see a scenario play out in 2022 where the Fed is raising interest rates and inflation is still challenging, then that could spell long-term challenges or headwinds for the farm sector. We could see inflation continue to be a concern. We could see high levels of interest rates continue to be a concern. On the other side, maybe the optimistic side, if we see inflation start to abate or start to slow down as supply chains get restarted, that could be less pressure on the Fed to raise interest rates here in the next year or 18 months.
As always, policy coming out of Washington, D.C. will be a concern for American agriculture.
D.C. and the policy priorities, the last 2 years have been really focused on COVID and the economy and sort of the recovery from situations we've had starting back in 2020 and lingered with us the last 2 years. But we've started to push through that potentially. Maybe, hopefully, we don't have as much focus on stimulus efforts coming out of Congress or COVID relief efforts. And maybe we get ahead of the disease a little bit. So the question is, what will Congress and the White House focus on?
Global tensions will also play a part in the agricultural economy during 2022. Once again, that was ag economist David Widmar.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
The California Hemp Association was founded in 2015 as a nonprofit association, and since 2018, Wayne Richmond has been serving as the executive director. I asked him if the hemp industry was a big industry in California.
There's lots of different nuances to the answer to that. No, it's not a big business in California. There's the bottom line. Can it be? Yes, it can be. How? Well, better regulations, more coordination between the counties and CDFA and farmers, less worry about cannabinoids versus marijuana. I mean, we live in a state where literally I have three dispensaries within a quarter mile of my home, and I as an adult can go buy marijuana all day long, right? But somehow hemp is this big boogie crop that, you know, people are like, oh, well, it looks like marijuana, so we don't trust you. You must be a criminal mind, right? And seriously, that is a lot of the law enforcement mindset. Now, it's changing some, and in some counties, they've just, you know, said, we don't care, okay? We welcome it all. So we have a whole range of reactions in the state of California, and we have 58 counties. Hey, we have more difficulty organizing California into a cohesive market for about anything because we have 58 counties that are like 58 states within a state because we were once a republic. So therein lies the fundamental challenges on getting a lot of stuff done. But having said that, The industry itself nationally has changed tremendously in just the past 2 years. And it went from a big cannabinoid CBD rush to make a ton of money. And that was akin to the land rush of, you know, the late 1800s and the gold rush. And, you know, here we are. Things have finally cleared out. There, a lot of people got hurt. The industry shrunk considerably in many areas. But what it did do was kind of clarify things, and really people are pivoting. So where CBD was the main topic of conversation, if you talked about hemp, and people were talking ridiculous amounts of money per acre that they could yield, that market basically collapsed. So back to the sanity of what the market could have been and should have been from the beginning, in my opinion, and it's based on historical facts, and that is food, fiber, and building materials. And hemp provides all of that.
Richmond explains some of the historical uses for hemp and what some of the current uses for hemp are.
So George Washington grew hemp. Thomas Jefferson grew hemp. Betsy Ross's flag is made of hemp fiber. The draft of the Constitution is on hemp paper. There was a time farmers had to pay their taxes in hemp, and hemp was big in World War II for ropes that kept ships attached to docks. In addition, Henry Ford built a car primarily using hemp materials from the body to the lubricants to all the other stuff back in, I think, the 1920s, if I recall.
And he says hemp seeds are a superfood.
They have the perfect balance of LDLs, HDLs, and omega and amino acids. That literally, you know, water and a bag of hemp seeds will keep you going for about 3 weeks before your body says, hey, I'd like something else to eat. But nutritionally, it's that good. So when you look at that, and then we haven't even gotten to the really good stuff. Okay, I mean, that's just the pedestrian, low-hanging fruit stuff that's pretty obvious to those of us who've researched this industry. And I assure you, I spent a lot of time researching this industry, and I have experience on both sides of the cannabis equation in terms of people I know, information I have, and life experience. And while they are both the same technically genetic crop, they are two different distinct varieties, and obviously THC is the big factor, right? But that doesn't do what hemp can do. And when I say hemp, I'm talking, you know, we refer to it as industrial hemp. The stalks are long and tall. They grow like bamboo or like corn stalks. And when you plant that kind of fiber and grain variety hemp, you then get some additional benefits that we haven't talked about. And that is carbon capture. 1 acre of a densely packed fiber variety hemp crop will, in California, in any case, that's where we have the numbers from, thanks to Dr. Peter Schwartz of Cal Poly Pomona, approximately 7 to 8 tons per acre are captured in the crop itself and another 1 ton in the soil. That makes for a pretty remarkable passive solar carbon capture machine that I think scientists would be hard-pressed to create right now. And yet, here it is in this plant. And then beyond that, the root balls of this crop help remediate the soil, making it more healthy by removing toxins and heavy metals and things like that. Obviously, when hemp is used as a rotation crop, as opposed to a primary crop, an additional benefit you get is with crop rotation. And this particular crop, you get some soil remediation, but you also change up the bug pressure. This farmer knows these are important factors to keeping your soil healthy.
He says they will be sharing that information and encouraging people to learn more about hemp at the upcoming World Ag Expo.
So the California Hemp Association and Foundation are the producers of all the hemp events, hemp sessions at the World Ag Expo this year. I personally am producing them. There's 4 of them. So one will be Hemp Across America with the chair of the National Hemp Association and various other members of organizations that span the country, who will be able to give, you know, regional perspectives on everything from legislation to growing conditions and whatnot. Okay. Then we have the California Hemp Report, which speaks for itself. California farmers and people who are on the Industrial Hemp Advisory Board will be having an open, frank conversation about the state of hemp in California. In addition, we will be having another session on hemp as a building material. And so the U.S. Hemp Building Association's president will be presenting along with various members of his team and farmers and processors who are involved with both growing hemp and then processing it into what's called hemp hurd, H-U-R-D, which is the woody part of the plant that can be used for building materials as well as animal bedding. Animal bedding is super healthy. Why? Because hemp is naturally antimicrobial. So it's way better than putting hay down. And you can get much longer use out of it because it's antimicrobial.
The World Ag Expo will take place February 8th through the 10th in Tulare, California.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.